underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Alexandra Fuller is best known for her best-selling memoirs about her African childhood and the family she left behind, including Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight and Leaving Before the Rains Come. She has just written her debut novel, Quiet Until the Thaw. The book brings us into the world of the Lakota Oglala Sioux Nation in South Dakota, and the fiction family she has imagined there. It was inspired by Fuller's time in 2011, accompanying 400 Lakota Indians as they rode cross-country to commemorate the murder of Crazy Horse. Again, the new novel is Quiet Until the Thaw, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Alexandra Fuller back to The Book Show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me back. It's great to be here.
How long have you known that you had a novel in you?
I started out writing wildly unsuccessful novels. I wrote about 10 until my agent fired me and said, you might have a little bit of skill, but you don't have a story. And so that set me off on a nonfiction path. But I always wanted to return to fiction.
So how did you know that this was the time, and more specifically, that this was the story you wanted to tell?
I didn't. This was a huge surprise for me. I mean, I assumed my first novel would be set in the countries of my youth, you know, the countries that imprinted on my soul and my psyche and that had sort of raised me. So that was and the first sort of 24 years of my life. I mean, I assumed that's where I would return to, is where my nonfiction is primarily set. In the interim, you know, I'd married, I'd moved to the States, I'd written extensively for National Geographic magazine, which, you know, I think is still part of the dominant narrative. I think that it's still, you know, that kind of media that's very set in a certain sort of linear way of writing. But that is, in fact, what got me initially to the res was on assignment for National Geographic. And the fact-checking and the sort of way in which I think dominant white settler narratives go did in no way do honor or respect or really justice to the real story I wanted to tell of my experience of being out there on the res for 3 months and my understanding, you know, of what I was seeing, because I came very much from an immigrant perspective, but from an immigrant who is not afraid, you know, of the label white settler. And so when Lakota were using that word to me, it felt to me like it resonated and that I knew what to do with this material because I'd been here horribly before, you know, in the oppressive white supremacy of Rhodesia, which created homelands, not reservations.
But it's fascinating that once you were there and you encountered this, you didn't want to leave.
Yeah. It was, for me, a really, I mean, again, this is a difficult thing, right? I think in white settler narrative and trope, we celebrate the wisdom and the land attachment of our indigenous communities without also addressing the fact that there is this ongoing and historical injustice leading with the breakdown of the treaties, the 500 treaties that the U.S. government made with indigenous communities. But at the same time, it was the first time since coming to the U.S. where I was with people whose understanding of time resonated with the understanding of time that I had understood from the indigenous communities that I grew up with in, you know, what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Also, the narrative of resistance was very familiar to me. And I mean, I immediately resonated with that, that for, you know, when you arrive here, I think very much the dominant narrative is that the Indian wars are over. The Indian story is dead. It's historical. We have a museum there. Go look at that. Not, no, this is an ongoing living resistance, that this is your responsibility as a U.S. citizen to understand this. But that also for me, this was the one place where, I mean, I think I was comfortable. It was a deep spirituality, an experience of that for sure, that I think I miss here, where, you know, the spirituality of capitalism is shopping.
Mm. I want to talk about these two fictional cousins that you created. You choose Watson and Rick Overlooking Horse. When did they start to come into your mind and and start to populate that landscape that you were becoming more and more familiar with?
I met a wonderful man who's quite famous among the Lakota and off the res for his resistance, and his wife, Alex White Plume and Deborah White Plume, have been amazing in the resistance and you know, standing up for clean air and clean water for all of us, not just on, you know, the treaty lands of the Sioux. And so speaking with Alex White Plume, long interviews, his tolerance, his patience, his forbearance, well, he, you know, educated me and allowed me, you know, to try and understand this way of life. So very much Rick is part of Alex White Plume, certainly. But my father died in the 5 years during which time I was writing this novel. And a lot of my father's wisdom came out of Rick Overlooking Horse. It was a relief to have a place to put that. Weirdly, it wasn't because my father was some great, you know, enlightened man at the beginning. He wasn't. I mean, growing up, he donned the uniform of white oppression and literally went to war in a racial bush war. But by the time he died, he had filtered so much of his, you know, imperialism and his, you know, that entitlement to colonize and to settle. That had been filtered out of him. I mean, he really, by the time he died, had become almost a monk in his existence. And I think that the oppressor and the oppressed, I think we need to be so careful with those terms, because there assumes, you know, that the oppressors are powerful and the oppressed are not. My father, I watched him understand that internal liberation is the only liberation you can hope for. And by accident, because your liberation is tied up with the liberation of all other people, you will become less oppressive. And so putting some of that hard, learned experience onto the page was a huge relief.
These two cousins are both abandoned by their mothers. They are raised together by their grandmother. At a very young age, they are sent to an Indian boarding school, Fort Carmichael. One of them escapes military service, but eventually starts going down this a violent path with drugs and crime. The other goes off to war and is badly injured. So then they come back, and that reuniting, how did you want that to be the jumping off point of this relationship and the story that you wanted to tell, not only of these two cousins, but of the Lakota people?
You know, I think that when you're raised in a white community, you assume you can discard your family. You know, if they disagree with you, if they're, you know, from a different political party, or they're homophobic or homosexual or whatever, you could willy-nilly, you know, you can just chop off bits of your community, because so what? You're in the dominant culture anyway. This is not true of communities who are under huge pressure. There is, I think, a deep understanding that hurt people hurt, that so much of internal violence is in reaction to, you know, an ongoing, I guess, expression of what has been inflicted. Or, you know, I think that that was an important thing for me to sketch out, that what it takes to stay Lakota is so much more than what it takes to stay a white settler. There's no effort in that. But to stay Lakota, one has to really, you know, be deeply attached spiritually and deeply able to actually live that very physical spirituality, very tough.
Alexandra Fuller is our guest. The name of the new novel is Quiet Until the Thaw. It is published by the Penguin Press. This kinship that you have with Lakota traditions, when did you start to realize how deep that kinship ran?
I mean, I think that very quickly somewhere, really, I mean, I would say almost immediately, the fact that I was lucky enough to ride onto the res after, you know, it was a long ride. It's a couple of hundred miles and very, very hot. It was middle of summer. To feel, again, what it is to be a racial minority, I think is very healthy for white people in general. And honestly, it's the way that I grew up. But also to feel deeply humiliated. I think one of the things that is one of the trances, I think, that we're in as white settlers is that everybody else is just a failed attempt at being us. And in fact, I just was failing miserably at even trying to stay on a horse. I mean, this was a tough ride. And I was raised, you know, to sort of tough it out in these rough farms I grew up on in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Zambia. But the absolute, I mean, for me, that entry point, I think, was just right, that I came in blistered, exhausted, sunburned, diminished. And that's really as it should have been. I think it immediately resonated with me that this was a place where my deep listening would be the biggest requirement. And that resonated, too, with just this monstrous gap in our storytelling, a monstrous gap in our understanding, and our monstrous ignoring of the fact that the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, that statistics are appalling, and that when we see massive disparity like that, where life expectancy for men is between 46 and 48 years old, women 52, annual income $4,000 a year. You know, when we see that kind of disparity, sadly, I'm on home territory. I've spent my whole life reporting from places where that disparity is a sure indicator that politically and usually with the backing of military, this is an arrangement. This isn't an accident. This isn't some unfortunate demographic is just unable to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. This is an ongoing campaign.
I'm struck by your use of the word diminished. It's a beautiful description of it. I think it seems to me in reading the novel and having read your past books that you can take one of two paths then, right? You can say, you can kind of skulk off and feel fully diminished by it and then try to just forget that it exists, or have it fundamentally change you, which certainly seems to be the case for you.
Absolutely. You know, it was Henry J. Nguyen that said, you don't think your way into a new kind of living. You live your way into a new kind of thinking. And, you know, part of being a reporter that I think has not taught enough, instilled in us as writers, is that your primary way of being needs to be vulnerable. I mean, that sort of softness. And I was more than halfway through the novel when in 2014, my then 22-year-old daughter sent me A Litany for Those Who Aren't Ready for Healing by the Afro-Christian scholar Yolanda Pierce. She wrote these words in 2014, and the litany ends with the lines, "Let us be humble and listen to the pain, rage, and grief pouring from the lips of our neighbors and friends. Let us decrease so that our brothers and sisters who live on the underside of history may increase. And let us listen to the shattered glass and let us smell the purifying fires, for it is the language of the unheard." And that litany really became my litany, my daily prayer.
And you can see that in the novel then, can't you? I mean, did that help you flesh it out? Did that help you in finding your way to the story you wanted to tell?
It's so ironic. It was the opposite of fleshing out. It was a decreasing of every word. You know, it was this.
A diminishment, then.
Yes. I mean, I think really to just try and end up with what was essential and to understand that we, the white settler, the dominant narrative, has muscled so much room on the shelf, that for me it was really important that I write something so sharp, so essential, because I'm very aware of the fact, too, that, you know, my audience is not going to be, you know, Indigenous communities and communities of color. That is not who comes to my reading groups. That is not, you know, we are not as diverse as we like to pretend we are. I mean, that just is not my experience of this country. You have to really seek out diversity. And so I knew that I would really be writing this for, you know, an audience like me who I wanted them to experience this very essential place, and that it shows in comparison how phenomenally overfed and glutted we are, and how much of a race we are to continue that unsustainable growth, the exploitation, and, you know, the end result of manifest destiny.
It's hard to read this novel, as it is hard to read some of your earlier work, without thinking, well, why does it have to be this way? Or why does it have to be that way? Why do these people have to live in an oppressed way?
Right. I mean, I think that goes back to, you know, what I said earlier, you know, which is that this very simple equation exists. Capitalism, you know, replaces a culture with consumption. And that consumption becomes a kind of religion, and vivid inequality within a nation is the unmistakable marker of a political and military arrangement. It's not an unfortunate geography. I come at it sideways in the book, but it's that old trope, you know, if we can put a man on the moon, we can dot, dot, dot. And so I have that, you know, the last trip of a U.S. astronaut to the moon, and so juxtapose that with what is actually happening on the res at the time. And I think that we, as, you know, Americans, who white settlers who have assumed the power, the water, the land, the political power, everything else, you know, that this is, it's an important crack for us to put on our own armor.
Talk a little bit about these characters specifically and what you enjoyed about writing about them. I was taken by the idea of always referring to them as Rick overlooking Horace. Is that cultural, or was that a stylistic decision that you made?
Thank you for noticing that. It was a stylistic decision that be the signpost that this is who we pay attention to. Mm. But well noticed. And I think that that is the wonderful thing, I think, about writing a novel, is you can use these stylistic devices as, you know, really, I think, signposts for the reader. Ah, pay special attention. This is the person whose respect we are trying to get, you know, weirdly, as the reader. This is the person to whom we should really be putting our attention.
And it does give a respect, and it almost gives you more of a sense, and more of an intimacy, when it's you choose Watson and Rick overlooking Horace.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that we have done such a good job of othering people who are not of the dominant culture in this nation. I didn't want to assume an intimacy, but I wanted to create that intimacy through respect. And by giving the whole name, I think that is a way of at least signaling that.
These bursts of chapters that you have written, also stylistic, and a stylistic choice, I assume, but it seems to fit the motif so well, in that it is a journey, and it comes to us in bursts, and in the end we realize how far we have traveled.
You know, when I was interviewing Alex Whiteplume out on the res, and of course I'm there with my tape recorder and my pen, and I'm writing avidly everything he says, and he finally stopped me and he said, "You have no faith in yourself, do you?" I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, look at you. You've got to record me. You've got to write me down. I mean, why are you so afraid of listening?" And I realized what a defense it was, what a defensive stance it was, that I somehow wanted to go back and prove he had actually said this. I mean, what you need to do if you're writing for a magazine that has fact checkers. But that was a great signpost for me that I had been going about this the wrong way, that my vulnerability, you know, I wasn't bringing that vulnerability. And I really wanted to do that for the reader reading this, to deconstruct the dominant narrative that we're used to, which is this more linear way of going forward, or that there's this hand-holding, or that we, you know, do this pandering, I think, in a way. And I wanted to remove all of that. And the easiest way to do that seemed to be to write in these shards, in these glimpses, in these glances, and so that it felt like what one needs to do to understand this book is to listen, like the way you would listen to jazz, as opposed to try and force it into some sort of, you know, order and, you know, goose march this novel forward. That, I think, to me feels like old dominant narrative way of being.
I was recently told by a best-selling author that if you look at a body of work, that the first novel is often the most autobiographical. That was coming from a fiction writer. So having written memoir before, when you get to your first novel, you can look at this as very personal and very autobiographical.
Right. Yes. It was easily the truest thing I've ever written. And that just, I mean, it feels to me sacrilegious to say that. And I think, again, you know, I can't imagine the horror, really. I mean, your indigenous community, and now you have a white settler writing your book and saying, yes, this pain echoes so vividly my pain. I think that would be a really revolting equation to make. But what I could not recognize is that I grew up with oppressors. I mean, that was they were gun-toting oppressors on the front line of a racial bush war. And I was raised white supremacist until I was 11 and independence came to Zimbabwe. I think that does something to your consciousness that allows you to understand that, yeah, you know, it was a rough childhood because, you know, there was such an insistence on fighting for our whiteness. And so I saw the shards of that violence. I wasn't on the receiving end of that violence, but I have enough shards that I can dive into those wounds and imagine, oh, the flip side of the coin. And how damaged, by the way, our white settler community was by our oppression, how much wisdom we ignored, how narrow our view. And it was nice for me, you know, I think from a biographical point of view, to actually just say that outright in this novel, which I've never done in my memoirs, to say, wow, we lost so much wisdom, we were so violent, so determinedly ignorant, so exhaustively hating, so absolutely determined that God was on our side. I mean, I joke that, listen, one clue that you're being raised by white supremacists is if your God hates, you know, Muslims and homosexuals and women. Mm. And if your Jesus looks like a love child between like Celine Dion and Kurt Cobain, you might be being raised by white supremacists.
You point out the Lakota saying, time comes around again and again and again, not my time, just time.
Yes.
How should we take that?
Well, don't be too arrogant about how your time is working out for you, and try not to be too distressed about it, which is a very dangerous thing to say, I think, when you're the oppressor. You don't get to say that. But internally, I think it is. In all the major religions except for Christianity, which stripped out, I believe, the feminine and removed the divine, except in, you know, Orthodox Christianity, in which the divine is within. But, you know, this idea exists in all other cultures that time is going to come around and you don't know where you will be when it returns. I mean, in other words, it is your job, I think, to look for the moment that you're in, and to make it the most, you know, the most just, equitable time that it can be, and to look for eddies for the way out of violence, and to look too for ways to heal ancestrally, you know, what your people have done, what you continue to do. What my people have done, what I continue to do.
Alexandra Fuller's debut novel is Quiet Until the Thaw. It is gorgeous and shimmering. It is published by Penguin Press. Alexandra, thank you so much for sharing with us. What a great treat to speak with you again.
It's a treat to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.